This is a report of interview with Captain Thomas Charles Pullen, Royal Canadian Navy, retired in Ottawa. Well, Tom, thank you for coming to the Park Lane today. We were talking the other day at the Rideau Club and here before we started, and I told you that one of my first questions was when did you join the Royal Canadian Navy and why? And you showed me a transcript of the Pullen family, a record of sea service. So first I'll read that into the record, and I don't have to then ask you why you joined. This reads in four columns. Column one is name, column two is born oblique died, column three is served, column four is years, column five is rank, and column six is service. So we start with column one, Nicholas, 1761 to 1819, 1780 to 1819, years 38, warrant officer, merchant service 1 and Royal Navy, merchant service brackets 1 and Royal Navy brackets 37. Underneath that, William, 1779 to 1827, 1794 to 1827, 33, Lieutenant, Royal Navy and Merchant Service. Under that, Samuel George, 1795 to 1854, 1801 to 1843, 31, Lieutenant, Royal Navy and Coast Guard. Underneath him, William John Samuel, 1813 to 1887, 1828 to 1870, 42, Vice Admiral, Royal Navy and Surveying Service. Underneath him, Tom Charles, 1815 to 1888, 1830 to 1872, 42, Captain, Royal Navy, which, strangely enough, is exactly the same as you, Tom. You're a Thomas Charles, and you were a captain, too. Underneath that is Hugh Francis, 1825 to 1883, 1844 to 1874, 31, Paymaster-in-Chief, Royal Navy. And that, of course, Tom, is the name of your brother, Hugh Francis, the Rear Admiral. Underneath that is William Charles, 1848 to 1894, 1863 to 1873, 10, Assistant Paymaster, Royal Navy. Underneath that is Thomas Francis, 1851 to 1889, 1865 to 1889, 24, Commander, Royal Navy. William Legate, that's spelled L-E, capital G-E-Y-T, 1854 to 1922, 1872 to 1914, 42, Paymaster Rear Admiral, Royal Navy. Underneath that is Charles Harper, 1883 to 1856, 1914-20, oblique, 1939-46, 14, Lieutenant, Royal Navy. Underneath that is Enid Mary, 1894 to 1954, 1914-18, oblique, 1939-45, 5. All capital letters, WRNS, Royal Navy. Basil William Legate, 1895 to 1958, 1908 to 1932, 24, Commander, Royal Navy and Royal Australian Navy. Underneath that, John Richardson Legate, 1899 to 1914, 1911 to 1914, 3, Midshipman, Royal Navy. Underneath that is John Cecil, 1902 to 1964, 1944 to 1945, 1, radio operator, merchant service. Hugh Francis, 1905 to 1983, 1920-22 and 1924-60, 39, Rear Admiral, Merchant Service 2, Royal Canadian Navy 37, Thomas Charles, that's you, 1918-, you're still with us, 1936 to 1965, 30, Captain, Royal Canadian Navy. John William Frank, 1949-, he's still with us. 1968-, he's still with us. 16, Lieutenant Commander, Canadian Coast Guard and Canadian Forces Reserve. I guess that's Hugh's son, isn't it? Now, the total number of years served by the members of the Pullen family at the end of column 1, 2, 3, 4, at the end of column 4, the total years served is 425 years, and this was compiled by you in Ottawa on the 27th of January, 1984. Now, since we've started on documents, instead of starting in the usual place, we'll talk, Alec Douglas is always keen to know what naval memorabilia is around. I know, for instance, that you have two magazines from HMS Frobisher, the training cruiser for 1936 and 1937. Alec Douglas would be interested in those. What were you telling me about your letters?
Your mother. Yes, my parents kept every letter I wrote from the time I joined the Navy. And when we broke up the home in Oakville and distributed all the bits and pieces, I appointed myself a record keeper, and I came across all these letters, and they cover the period pretty well from 1936 up until latter years, when I was, my last seagoing command was provider, I think, in the 60s, and possibly even later. And I've categorized them and filed them, and they're all there. I've read a few, and I must say they do serve to trigger memories. I have also been a compulsive diary writer. I have a diary for 1931, which I wrote full of illiteracies when I was a small boy at Lakefield, and I've tried to keep it up over the years. I was always enraged that during World War II we were not allowed to keep our own personal records, though senior officers seem to think themselves above and exempt from this rule. I have all my midshipman's journal for the time 1937, 1938. I have kept journals after I left the Navy of all the ships I have been north in, and there are about 5 or 6 volumes of those. In addition, I have 3 volumes of my own personal diary transcribed for my service in HMCS Labrador, 1956, 1957. I have 4 volumes of my reports of proceedings transcribed for the same period in HMCS Labrador, or in other words, the official and the private impressions of my time there. I have 3 volumes of personal records. I have another volume which is transcripts of some of my diaries, a project which I'm still engaged in, and 4 or 5 volumes of the Manhattan Voyage in 1969. And I also have about 10 volumes of transcriptions for my grandfather's letters during the time he served in the Royal Navy in 1870 and covering the period when he came out to Canada so that he might marry his deceased wife's sister, something which was forbidden by the Anglican Church at the time. And there are assorted other records around, but that probably covers most of it.
Well, I like Douglas sort of getting in touch with you on this, and I'm going to speak to him when I see him on Monday about the present book that you're thinking of writing. What will that encompass?
I've had a bee in my bonnet for years that I'd like to put on paper my Arctic experiences, because they cover a period of 20 years since I left the Navy, though including my 2 years in command of Labrador. And I suppose they fall into 3 categories, command of the Labrador, the Arctic, the Manhattan, the Northwest Passage Voyage, and the rest. And the rest covers quite a lot, about 15 different expeditions.
Well, you've got a lot of writing ahead of you, and Alec Douglas will be interested to know. He'll offer you, I know, whatever support he can.
For which I'd be truly grateful.
So that's that. Well, I guess we better get back from your captain's time to your cadet's time. You were born in Oakville.
Yes.
Betty is an Oakville girl. Let's get her into naval history right away.
Well, I didn't meet Betty until the summer of 1936, with my departure for England imminent. So that we'd only known each other for a couple of weeks, and off I went, and I wrote her a postcard, which was mailed in Quebec as the Esonia dropped down river, and that was the trigger which started a correspondence which has been going on nonstop for the last, I hesitate to mention it, 40 years or so or more. And when I didn't come back to Oakville until 1938, and we sort of picked up where we left off, I suppose you could express it. And again, I went off, and eventually I was married on my survivor's leave in 1942. We were married, I should say.
Yes. well, I have a parallel experience. I don't know how long Alma and I have been married, although we've got a 38-year-old son, so I hope it's 39 years. But I took her to high school dances.
Yeah, well, those are lasting relationships, I think.
Well,
I'm happy to say that I have 4 grandsons. I have 2 grandsons who are 6 foot something and rising, who are 17, twin boys. So these are great times.
Yeah, the beauty of grandchildren is you can hand them back to their parents when you're tired of them.
That's right. Return them to stores.
Return them to stores. So, did you have to write competitive examinations to get into the Navy?
We had to be medically fit, medically examined. We had to be interviewed by a bunch of bad-tempered naval officers, and we also had a whole series of academic hurdles to negotiate. These exams were written in the summer of 1936. And my fellow termmates did the same, though I didn't know who they were going to be at the time. And I'm not quite sure how it worked, but I must have passed because I was accepted.
You remember your interview board?
I have a vague recollection of going to Ottawa. This was a Saturday. I've got it in my diary. And the only member of the board I recall was Adrian Hope, Boomer Hope.
Yeah.
And he really was a... asked very kind and helpful questions. I was terrified at the prospect of the interview, but like so many things in life, when you actually confront it and endure it and experience it, it's never as bad as you think it will be.
So you were accepted, and you went to the UK, and you joined Frobisher. Who was the first man you met from Frobisher?
Well, we review this, yes. The one man who... the memory of whom is etched in my mind was the gunner in Frobisher, Mr. Marjo, who I think all cadets at the time will know, will remember. He was a little man, but he certainly knew all about taking charge. And when we arrived at the station, the first thing I heard him say was that, quote, "When I say move, you'll move," something like that, expressed with some ferocity. And we feared and respected this little man throughout our time in the Frobisher, though towards the end we found that he did have a mellow side.
Yes, that's usually the way, isn't it?
Indeed.
So you joined her, and the cadets were working part ship, part-time schoolwork, and part ship the rest of the day. And you went on your first cruise to where?
First cruise was around UK with a side trip to Bergen in Norway. We sailed from Chatham and went up through the North Sea, north to Bergen. We visited Rosyth, Invergordon, Campbelltown on the west coast, and came down through the Irish Sea and so back to base again. And nothing really sticks out in my mind about it except I think I smoked my first cigarette while we were sailing in a gale in Bergen Harbor. We were having the usual weekly maneuvers under sail in the cutters and whalers, and it was a pretty miserable business. But Bergen was a very happy occasion, my first foreign port, mm-hmm. or first foreign port, I guess, for all the Canadian cadets.
Mm-hmm. What Canadians were with you?
We were a group of eight, and Ralph Hennessy, Bill Landymore, Bob Welland, Joe Barber Starkey, Jack Blakelock, Bob Murdoch, and Robert Welland.
Mm-hmm. I interviewed Bob a couple of months ago. He had good things to say about Frobisher.
Yeah, so, it was a happy time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And your next cruise, I expect, was the West Indies.
The next cruise was the West Indies, yes, and we had some pretty heavy weather going across the Atlantic, and the barometer demonstrated its ability to drop very severely. And I remember that heavy seas broke up the blast screen abaft Aegon, and the Green Sea caught it. There were a lot of seasick cadets during that period. It didn't seem to bother me. And our first port of call was Barbados. It was my first visit to tropical regions, so it was a novel experience and a very happy one. And we went from there to Grenada, recently in the news, but Grenada at that time was mostly just lush green country. But we anchored in off the main town, of course, St. George. The cruise is marked by some sadness because we lost two cadets who died from meningitis, I think. And this caused quite a lot of worry, as you can imagine. And we went north to Bermuda. I recall ship anchoring in Grassy Bay. But Bermuda, then as now, is very much tourist-oriented, and there was a great hoo-ha ashore, people protesting the fact that we were there and that on no account would be allowed ashore because of the threat of whatever it is, contagion. And so we spent a rather miserable time in the rain and the wind at anchor in Grassy Bay. I think we were allowed ashore in the dockyard to stretch our legs from time to time. So my first visit to Bermuda was not a particularly happy one. And so back to England.
Mm-hmm. It was for either Ralph Hennessy or Bob Welland. They got into the... They weren't allowed to go into any buildings, but they were allowed to go ashore in Ireland Island. And they found out that they didn't have to go into the wet canteen, that they could throw their money in and get beer passed out. So they were sitting happily in front of the wet canteen, and the captain and the commander and Mr. Marjo walked by. They stood up and bowed deferentially. The captain returned the salute. They went on. Whoever told me this, one of those two, said it was a perfect Bob Hope double take. They all got about 10 paces beyond them, and suddenly they all stopped and looked back, and Marjo came striding back. "What are you cadets doing here?"
Too good to last.
Back to the ship. Leave that beer where it is. Back to the ship, you two.
That wretched man. You would have thought he might have put a blind eye. I hadn't heard that, but that's good.
So back to the UK.
Yes, only two cruises for our lot, because of the need to get to to get the system moving as fast as possible because of the war clouds that were gathering, I suppose. And we all went ashore on leave, awaiting with some apprehension our appointments as midshipmen.
And you went? No, you were allowed to apply where you wanted to go.
You could indicate a preference. As I recall it, I think we had first and second choice. I was reading a letter to my family wherein I say that Bob Murdoch and I, we'd become good friends. He indicated a preference for the West Indies, and I indicated a preference for the Mediterranean because I felt it would be better in a big fleet. And my brother was in the Mediterranean, of course, so there was naturally a tug there. And eventually, when the appointments came out, we both went to the Mediterranean. We both went to the same ship, HMS Shropshire, first cruiser squadron.
So what happened in Shropshire?
With Shropshire?
I have a piece of paper.
A piece of paper?
Yeah. Any piece of scrap paper.
Yeah.
Shropshire.
County class cruiser, 10,000 tons. She was one of four ships in the first cruiser squadron, the flagship of which was HMS London. The other ships were Devonshire and Sussex. Shropshire had been in the Mediterranean. She was approaching the end of a 2.5-year commission. And she was commanded by a man called Tufty Tate. We are RN post captains with who's mostly eyebrows. but a very pleasant and friendly man, and I can remember him telling me that he had been to Canada. He had some connection, family connection, I understood, in Canada, and he was very good to midshipmen. And we were in Shropshire really quite a short time, but she was had come home for the Jubilee Review in 1937, and we joined at Spithead. And this joining one's first ship is quite a frightening experience, especially a counter-class cruiser, because they have a 30-foot freeboard, and the journey up the gangway to the quarter deck is a prolonged one. But we were, Murdoch and I were especially relieved to know that David Groose was the senior mid in the Shropshire, and he welcomed us and took charge and was able to introduce us to the shipboard life, as it was at that time, in a big cruiser.
Was there any caning in the gunroom in Shropshire?
No, there wasn't.
Yeah.
There was a good deal of horsing around, but I think that by that time the Royal Navy reached a stage where, for the most part, midshipmen were older and more mature.
Yeah.
The gunroom was a chap called Prendergast, and he was a very easygoing type. And so it was a somewhat loosely structured life.
Do you remember the Spithead Review?
Oh, yes, I have memories of that, particularly being introduced to as being midshipmen of the watch, surrounded by all these ships, many of them flagships, and the comings and goings of admiral's barges, flags flying, bands having to be paraded, all the hoo-ha with bugles and piping and so forth. An introduction, a very quick one, to a ceremonial in the Royal Navy.
And you saw the Royal Navy for the first time in all its might. Not all of it, but a good bit of it. I think the Med Fleet came up for it.
A lot of ships came, those that could be spared, because of the problems of the Mediterranean, those that could be spared were brought home for the Spithead Review. And as you say, it was to see the Royal Navy's, the might of the Royal Navy paraded at that time was certainly a marvelous experience for a young man. And I had been in love with the Navy and ships ever since I can remember. So there it was.
I asked Mickey Sterling why he joined the Navy. He said he was quite surprised. There was a good long pause on the tape. He said, there was never a time when I didn't want to join the Navy.
That's interesting. I wonder, I presume for a lot of people that is the case. I spent more time drawing ships and reading about them at school than I did studying, I think, which was frowned upon.
Yeah. I guess you got your first command in Shropshire in your picket boat.
Well, we didn't have pickup boats as such. We had motorboats. As a matter of fact, our time in Shropshire was short, but I was running boats because I can remember as we going inshore, passing the captain, coming out in his from an official call or something, and it was a terrible crime if the captain passed and he wasn't saluted by the midshipman of the boat, and so we were always on the lookout, and Tufty Tate would always acknowledge the mid-salute with a vigorous, exaggerated wave of his hand, just so that we would know he had seen us, and he knew that we existed and were doing our job.
That was good training for midshipmen, you know. The responsibility was yours, no matter what the weather was. You went away and did whatever your boat was supposed to do.
Yeah, it was...
And you're 18, eh?
18, yes. You were working, you were in charge of a boat, handling a boat. You had to get into the wretched thing down over the lower boom and down the Jacob's ladder, and if there was any sea running, it was a challenging business. And also when you secured the boat after you were finished, you'd go to the lower boom and have to get up out through up the Jacob's ladder and inboard. And it was just not on for the midshipman of the boat to have it brought alongside by her, by the coxswain, and you joined in comfort. And that meant, of course, that you became one of the team, the boat's crew and the boat's coxswain, and you built up that first relationship with a sort of officer man, though recognizing the fact that they knew you were not really an officer, and you knowing the fact, if you had any humility. It was a marvelous learning process for midshipmen.
I found as a midshipman that the ship's company tried to protect me from them officers. And
yes.
When I was in a jam, they'd jump into the breach. I remember once the captain told me to hoist a seaboat, and I sailed down all confidence, and they said, "Hooked onto the boat, sir," and I opened my mouth to give my version of stentorian bellow, and only a squeak came out, and I forgot. I panicked, and I forgot the next order. Somehow or other, the chief boatswain's mate materialized, and he was standing with his back to the commander, facing me without moving his lips. He said, "Hold taut singly. Marry the falls." And then I was all right. Now, that's the kind of relationship you're talking about?
Indeed it is. And it worked. I think people became matured into good officers because they were launched in such... so effectively launched with the support from the lower deck, especially the chief petty officers and petty officers, and indeed the leading seamen who were coxswains of boats. There was that special relationship. It's a unique one. It's gone now, of course.
But we had it in the RCN in the days that you and I were serving, I think.
Yes. Oh, indeed. Yeah, I think it's the whole system has changed now, and there's the times have changed also ashore, so that maybe it wouldn't work. I don't know about the Royal Navy. But of course, midshipmen as such are no longer with us.
No.
So we've lost something. It's probably been replaced by something else.
So Shropshire went where?
Shropshire was operating off the Spanish coast during the Spanish Civil War, and this was the period when... refugees were being evacuated from Valencia, and I'm not quite sure where they were taken, but we were running boats from shore out to the ship, and on one occasion there was a bombardment from further from seaward when shells were whistling overhead, and aircraft activity was there was quite a lot of it. It was really a minor overture to World War II, I suppose, certainly ashore.
You said shells are whistling overhead. Whose shells?
Well, this is the 8-inch cruiser Canarius, as I remember. Was in a bombardment role, and she made her appearance occasionally. Eventually, it was the Baleares, I think. Baleares.
What nationality is she?
Spanish. There were two 8-inch cruisers. They were similar they were Condeclass cruisers, essentially, 8-inch guns. Yes. But that was an interesting period for a young midshipman. But the time had come for Shropshire to return to England, and So we, MIDS, were reappointed to another ship in the squadron, and we went to Sussex.
So you must be a senior MID by now, are you?
Well, not really, no. Right. In the minds of many, we were still pretty junior.
But you weren't senior MID in the sense that Davy Groose was?
No, nowhere near. Nowhere near.
So you're in Sussex?
We're in Sussex, yes. And the sub-lieutenant of the gunroom was one Raymond Dreyer. And I found, may I quote a letter?
Please do.
All the gunroom of Shropshire has been broken up, with five of us, Groose going home with the two English mids, etc., etc. There are 20 in our gunroom, and the sub here in Sussex is a very good sort. In fact, when he was finding out just who we all were, he said, "Pullen, have you a relation called Pullen?" And I said, "Yes." He said he had been at Whale Island with him, and that he had been a veritable bully. Hence, he was going to get his revenge on me. This last as a joke, to my intense relief.
He was Dreyer of the Dreyer Table Dreyers, wasn't he?
He was the son of Admiral Sir Christopher Dreyer, as was Desmond Dreyer.
Is that the predecessor to the AFCC that we both know so well?
That's quite right. Dreyer was the Dreyer Table is attributed to the great to the admiral.
Yeah.
But there, I understand there was a great controversy in the Royal Navy because there was a man called Pollen.
Spell that.
P-O-L-L-E-N.
Oh.
And in fact, a book came out not long ago, the whole history of the controversy over who had developed the first fire control table. But anyway. The Dreyer Table, yes,
yeah.
And the poached egg and the whole thing, that was part of it.
What's the poached egg?
Well, the poached egg is the thing that, as I recall it, was part of the Dreyer Table.
Oh, was it?
Yes.
I had trouble enough with the AFCC. I never really understood the demerit, so you can see how I was.
You could have real problems. Yes, I'm trying to agree with you.
Dear. Well, when I did my long course, I had 2 years in a fleet destroyer and the rest of the time in corvettes. Yeah. And all the rest of the RN had time in destroyers and cruisers and battleships, and they were the choice of the Royal Navy out of 100 that had volunteered. And Larry Walker and I were the only two Canadians that had volunteered from Canada, so we were way behind them on the Gazintas.
I agree with you.
I had a hard time at Whaley.
Yes, yeah. I echo that view. I had 2 weeks in as a lieutenant when I was right away out of my long course, and up against people who with 4 years seniority and all sorts of big ship experience.
Yeah,
pretty tough road to hoe. Yeah.
So you're in Sussex, and you went where?
Oh, Sussex operated as a unit of the Mediterranean Fleet. There's a great deal of time devoted to fleet exercises operating out of Malta, and Malta was the main base. These were very instructive for me as a midshipman. My action station in the Sussex during the daytime was the control officer for the high angle control position, controlling 4-inch guns, four of them, as I recall. And my action station at night was on the port wing of the bridge handling the searchlight sight to make sure that when the target was illuminated, that in fact when the shutters were open, the target would be illuminated, after which the guns would take over. This was a particularly challenging job at night because if you made a mistake, you were conveniently close to the captain and the gunnery officer, who could hurl all sorts of abuse at you over a situation which really might not be your own fault.
What was that thing called, the true TBI?
The TBI, true bearing
indicator. You had a TBI.
And if you could see through your binoculars on the TBI, you could see the target, then it was reasonable to assume that the search sights were pointing in the same direction. Sometimes this didn't happen.
When did it not happen to you?
Well, it happened rarely, but when it did, the abuse from the bridge was unmistakable. But and when the guns were firing in a full caliber shoot, and the target was abaft the beam, and A and B turret trained so that you could almost look down their muzzles and fired, it was quite a shock for those on that side.
I think we're all a little hard of hearing, aren't we?
And we pay the penalty, I suppose, later in life for that. Yes, it was long. It was before the days when people put in plugs to protect their hearing from loud these sounds. It was sort of at that time not done.
Yeah, not manly.
Silly.
Mm-hmm. Chief Pedafsa James, as gunner's mate on the West Coast, is having trouble with his hearing now, and he wanted me to write a letter saying that he was exposed to the blast of the guns. And he was my equipment and trials officer when I was OIC at the gunnery school on the West Coast. I said, well, I never inquired too much about what you were doing when you were equipment and trials officer, because he was the officer of this chief. I said, how did you measure when it was unbearable to the gun's crew on what bearings? And he said, well, I used to get closer and closer to the gun myself, and when I couldn't stand it anymore, I said, there. I said, well, I won't put that in the letter because they'll just think you're a bloody fool. But I wrote him the letter. So this can be, you can tell, if you ever apply for a disability pension, you can say that in the National Archives sits your first complaint.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I seem to be fortunate. My hearing is not, it doesn't seem to be been affected. So.
Well, now you've ruined it, you see.
Yes, I don't mind. Yeah.
So you were doing night shoots, and again, everybody in the Royal Navy felt the imminence of war.
The Mediterranean Fleet at that time was hard at it, training for the war that they knew was coming, and I think even the midshipmen recognized that it was a probability. And so that it was a steady procession of all the ships of the Mediterranean Fleet in and out doing exercises every day, night exercises. And I can remember when we were in harbor and the battleships were out doing full caliber shoots, that marvelous sound of the rumble of 15 and 16 inch guns below the horizon come rolling in.
Yeah.
It's a sound not easily forgotten.
Yes.
The great guns speaking.
I understand not much AA practice.
Well, I thought that there was quite a lot. They produced the radio-controlled Queen Bee target for us to attack, and ships would go to sea and form line ahead, and the radio-controlled target would start at the head of the line and go down port star side and starboard side, and everybody would blast away. I must say, not many hits were scored, but then it was really quite a small target. But the general view is that the standard of AA gunnery leading up to World War II in the Royal Navy was not all that hot, and that was simply because the technology of aircraft anti-aircraft gunnery hadn't kept pace with
the FKC of was really a rather it was a gallant effort, mechanical effort, but it
yes, it was.
We had no VT fuses to start with.
That's right,
and
so it was at best a guessing game. I think.
I know somebody else said who was in the Mediterranean Fleet. He met your brother, who was Squadron Flotilla G, and that Hugh was upset with the standard of AA gunnery, but didn't really know what to do about it. Well, as we've just said, there wasn't much you could do. He didn't have a good predicting system.
That's right. Yeah.
You met your brother later. Well, you met him in the Med Fleet.
Who, me?
Yeah.
Yes, oh, indeed, yes. Well, I spent a great deal of time in Malta, of course, at the house. It was a home away from home for me, and I was extremely fortunate to have that his family was there.
His family, what, Helen?
Helen and son, daughter, first, yes.
Yeah.
And so it was truly delightful, and as I say, I was very fortunate. But when I went to do my destroyer time, which all mids did, for 3 months, I was appointed to Hotspur in the 2nd Destroyer Flotilla, and my brother was Flotilla Gunnery Officer in that flotilla, Captain. Boyd was the Captain B.
B-O-Y-D.
B-O-Y-D, yes. My captain in Hotspur was Jackie Bickford. A splendid man who taught me a great deal about ship handling. because I spent a lot of time on the bridge. And destroyer officers in those days accepted midshipmen and passed on as much knowledge as they could. And knowledge, of course, which stood us, all the Canadians, in very good stead afterwards, because we all went back to destroyers. But Hotspur, for me, was not a particularly happy ship, because the first lieutenant either didn't like Canadians or didn't like midshipmen or both. My accommodation, I didn't have a cabin. I had to sling a hammock in the captain's cabin flat. And everybody came and went all around me during the night. I had very poor stowage space for my kit, and the first lieutenant perpetually gave me a hard time. So it was a bit grim. I must say I didn't enjoy it. If the captain hadn't been so good and the other officers, I don't know what I would have done. And after a month or so, I was appointed to HMS Hostile, another ship in the flotilla. Hotspur must have been going into dock, and this is no place for a midshipman. Hostile was commanded by Maxwell Richmond, a commander, and a splendid wardroom full of officers, anxious even more so to help a mid learn the ropes. I spent a happy time in Hostile, and was sorry to leave her to have to go back to my ship. I remember one incident with respect to my brother. The order came that each ship of the flotilla was to land a platoon for company drill on the parade ground in Gibraltar, where the fleet was at the time, and I was detailed off to be platoon commander. I went ashore, we all formed up, and awaiting the hurricane of abuse that was about to descend upon us, and to my astonishment, I was the cry went forth that the platoon commander of two platoon was to front and center to report to the parade commander, who was you know who, and I rushed out and arrived in front of him, saluted, and was given a tongue lashing, asked why I did not have gloves on, did I not read the signal, and so forth and so on. I didn't have any gloves. I'm not so sure I was conscious of the fact that the signal even mentioned gloves. So in front of the whole wretched parade, I was given a roasting, and I fell in. That whole incident on the parade ground afterwards was a bit of a shambles. It was my first introduction to parade ground work and company drill. And it wasn't until later, when I went back to Whale Island, that the whole thing became a rather delightful piece of cake and fun. But at that time, it was just bloody awful.
Well, you know, don't you, now, that something was going to be the matter with you when you were called in front of your brother. If it hadn't been your gloves, he would have found something.
Yes. Yes, what an opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah, I deserved it, and he was entitled to it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, I mean, there was just no way of avoiding a blast.
No.
Something else would have been wrong. That generation of officers, Boomer Hope said, he was a great one on hats. A gentleman would no more go ashore without his trousers than without his hat, Boomer Hope used to say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Your brother had the same thing on gloves.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Sir William Tennant had the same thing in Sheffield on hats. So they kept a hat on the quarterdeck, and you stuck a titfer on your head when you went over the brow, saluted the brow, went back alongside, sailed it back up to the quarterdeck, and the next fellow put the titfer on.
That's a marvelous story. It's like a felt frisbee.
Yeah, it's like a felt frisbee.
Oh, yeah. Yes, that hat thing was always a bloody nuisance, wasn't it? And everybody had to have a hat. A green pork pie, usually. Which
often.
It was nearly, a fashion.
Nearly always a pork pie, yes. Tony German still wears his.
I guess times have changed, and people now sort of click their heels or bow their head, or the American business of placing your hand over your heart. I guess there are all sorts of substitutes.
Yeah.
None of them really quite as effective as lifting your hat.
No. So you had a good time in Hostile with Richmond, who was also good with midshipmen.
Yes.
And you went back to Sussex.
Sussex. To finish our time out. And we at this time we were working up towards our seamanship examination for the rank of lieutenant, which is the great hurdle that faced all midshipmen at the end of their
time. The most important single one, too, I think.
Most important single one. I should add that we were required to have a week or two in an aircraft carrier, and it was courageous that was in dry dock or refit, and so we couldn't actually fly off the deck, so we were sent out to the air station at Halfar in Malta, and we received instruction there, and the RAF pilots took us off in Swordfish aircraft. That was my first flight ever, and I must say I thoroughly enjoyed it, as we all did, being able to look down on Grand Harbor and look down on Malta generally. Certainly a marvelous vantage point.
Well, they were gentle old ladies and grand old ladies. Do you know they did more damage to the Italian fleet at Taranto, those Swordfish, 12 of them, I think, one lost, than the whole of the British fleet did to the German fleet in the Battle of Jutland?
Well, I hadn't.
One of my sources tells me.
I hadn't heard that. I should imagine that Taranto is one of the high marks for
the Swordfish.
Work done by the Swordfish.
Yeah, A.B. Cunningham, yeah.
Yeah, as opposed to the sort of tragic business of the Scharnhorst and Eisenau going up the channel, and was it Esmond and leading his Swordfish into the attack against a wall of fire.
Yeah.
The funny
when they came in on Bismarck, they fired one at either Sheffield or Jamaica, too.
That's right. That's right, it missed, fortunately.
But, I remember the Swordfish. I remember a Swordfish landing on in the home fleet. Furious was doing 32 knots into about a 30-knot breeze, and so help me God, Tommy, at one point, Furious was gaining.
Yes, I can imagine it. I think their maximum still air speed was 95 knots. Yeah. Yes, I can well imagine
and that. I've seen, on Furious again, on the same trip, we were going up to try and sink the, what's that one that was in the fjord there?
Tirpitz.
Yeah, Tirpitz. Again, Furious, again going 30 knots into a 30 or 40 knot breeze. They were holding down the Swordfish, and when they let go, it went straight up.
Yes.
It had already attained flying speed.
A poor man's helicopter, eh?
A poor man's.
Yeah, I can just, I suppose they would with their lift, yeah. Well, they were brave men who flew those aircraft. And also the ones who, each cruiser was equipped with a Wallace.
You had one.
We had one. And they trained the bloody great catapult on the beam and squirted off. And that was the easy part, I think. The landing, of course, they, being a seaplane or amphibious aircraft, the ship would make a slick by altering course, and the Wallace would come down in the smooth area formed by this maneuver, and then taxi up under the crane. And the observer, or somebody, would have to get up and with the propeller whizzing right behind them, hook on to the. Not a job I would want. We never flew in the Walrus. It really, its flying abilities were a bit marginal.
Yeah.
And, but they did good work, I think, during the war, early part of the war, certainly, in the far reaches of the oceans, and reconnaissance flights.
So that's the flying in Sussex. What else in Sussex?
And then, again, work for the seamanship board, which when it came along, and I'm happy to say that I got a first, and so did Murdoch. The board was very good. They asked all the right questions, which was a pleasant surprise. But we had worked very hard. I know Bob and I have worked extremely hard to do well on this thing, and as I did the other mids, but they all didn't get first. There was a destroyer captain on the board, which was a great help to me, certainly. Chatwin was his name. Anybody who loved destroyers as I did, or as we did, was sure to score well with him.
You and Bob Murdoch studied together?
Yeah, we...
Your answers must have looked rather similar then.
Yes, yeah. Yes, there was a case in the Frobisher earlier on where we both gave the same answer to a question, and our approach to the answer apparently indicated to the torpedo officer at the time that there must have been some collusion or cheating or something, and he seemed to think that I'd been helping myself, and I took great offense at this. I couldn't convince him that in fact we'd worked together and had both produced the same sketch for our approach to this particular question. Yes.
So your main hurdle is over, your seamanship hurdle is over, you're a midshipman. What happened then?
The idea was to return to England and do our subcourses at Portsmouth, and we took passage on board HMS Royal Sovereign, an R-class battleship, back to England.
Wasn't there something about the Grand Mufti came in there?
Oh, yeah, I'd forgotten. Yes, was the Grand Mufti was removed from Palestine at that
Haifa.
Time. And from Haifa. The Sussex was dispatched to do this job, and she went to Haifa, and the Grand Mufti was, with considerable secrecy, brought off the ship and exiled to the Seychelles Islands in the Indian Ocean.
Who exiled him and why?
Well, this was all part of the ongoing problem with Palestine that seems to have been with us for a long, long, long time. And the British government decreed that the focus of the problem was the Grand Mufti. He was the troublemaker. He was the symbol, I suppose, of the situation.
The resistance, yeah.
And he should be removed. And this he was. Whether it had any effect or not, I don't know. But the area is still a hotbed of trouble.
Well, as I said before when we were chatting about this, Great Britain ran the empire much like a schoolmaster. This boy is causing trouble. Put him in Coventry.
That's right. Send him packing.
He went off to the Seychelles, did he?
Yes, he did. And he was actually transferred to another ship in the vicinity of Port Said. The Sussex didn't go all the way. First time I'd ever seen Sussex really doing her full power, 32 knots, I think it was.
Lovely sight. Lovely feeling.
Well, where we were, in the after end of the ship and the midshipman's chest flap right over the propellers, it was not particularly enjoyable. Sleep was impossible, and everything jumping up and down. Great ships. I was very happy in the Connacht-class cruisers. They were comfortable with tremendous deck head, lots of room. There was no shortage of space. Very good ships from an accommodation point of view.
And you went back to do your subscourses?
Subscourses, yes. First was Vernon, the torpedo school, excellent, the gunnery school, and the iron barracks for signals, and the navigation school at Dryad. And we emerged from those as...
acting sub-lieutenants?
As acting sub-lieutenants.
And you did no Greenwich time, of course.
No Greenwich time.
That was cut out because of the imminence of war. What year are we in now? We must be in...
This is 1939.
Oh, well.
In fact, I was at Whale Island when, on September the 3rd, Sunday at 11 o'clock, when war was declared. And very shortly after that, we were dispatched to our ships. Hennessy and I went off to Devonport to join the Assiniboine. Yeah. Was commissioning at that time.
I have a correction. Four Courageous, further up the page, it was the aircraft carrier Glorious. She was one of the new ones, wasn't she?
Well, I suppose so, yes. It's not all that good.
That's a midshipman's journal.
Yeah, from November the 13th to November the 26th.
Yeah.
We lived on board.
What year?
1938.
Glorious, 1938. From your midshipman's journal. That's a lovely journal. Alec Douglas will covet that too. That's a lovely picture of a submarine that I'm looking at and other ships. You're quite good with your... You're quite good drawings.
Well, that is my journal. I think it was... Of course, it was to teach people to express themselves, wasn't it?
Yes. Did the captain make any rude remarks on it?
Oh, yes. I once put a picture in of one of the dwarfs, seven dwarfs, Dopey, I think it was. And the captain did remark, the connection between this picture and the naval service is somewhat obscure. Mostly the snotty nurse just signed the thing, and but then he says, no, actually to... offer the smallest possible target, at the same time accept the most effective defensive formation. So
The Saudis were nurse. We just kept, they certainly kept an eye, but the 20 midshipmen writing journals must have been an awful chore for them.
Well, I read essays at the University of Victoria, so I know what the Saudis nurse felt like.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also used pictures, photographs for oiling.
Yeah.
So how are we doing?
That's the end of this section of the tape. We'll go on later.